Mr. Mayor, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your warm welcome. It's a great honor to me to be asked to address this first meeting of the convocation. Sir Gladwin Cheb asked me to send you his very sincere personal apologies for being unable to be here tonight. As the President explained, at this critical time in world affairs, it's hard for him to be here. Indeed, Mr. Bevin specifically forbade him to make the journey. And having watched Sir Gladwin at work over the weekend, I must say I can understand why. He is busy every moment, and I feel sure that in spite of your disappointment, you wouldn't want to rob our common cause of his experience and ability at the present very critical time. I had a long talk with him before I left, and have had the benefit of his judgment on United Nations affairs, though I must exonerate him from all responsibility for what I'm going to say. For this lecture, I and I only am to blame. Now, since I've come fresh from Britain, I feel you'd like me not only to speak about United Nations, but also to touch on another subject which seems to be of some topicality in your country, British foreign policy. Judging from some of your newspapers' views on some of us European countries, I think I should be wiser to stick rigidly to the subject of the United Nations. I could then be sure of leaving Kalamazoo in the same warm atmosphere of kindness and cordiality in which I was welcomed. But I feel deeply the need for our two countries to remain side by side in this present crisis, and feel that I should try, if I can, to remove any misunderstanding there may be also about what we're trying to do over on the other side of the Atlantic. Well, now, I expect you'll want to know whether the views in my lecture are representative of British opinion. I think that they are. It's true that I'm a member of the British Labour Party, but I'm sure that many British Conservatives, as well as Socialists, would agree with what I'm going to say. This is partly because I shall follow the good British custom whereby members of political parties don't attack their rival party when they go abroad. Tonight I propose to treat the Conservatives magnanimously, mercifully, and to make up for it when I get home. In any case, though, of course, British people of all parties are united today on the main issues of foreign policy. We don't have any formal bipartisanship. We don't invite opposition members to share in the framing of policy. But we do succeed in agreeing on the main issues. Now, I propose, therefore, to discuss first the contribution of the United Nations, and then the contribution of Britain to peace and democracy in the world today. First, United Nations. When we think back to our great hopes of this organization after the war, and then think of present events in Korea, it's easy to take a very dark view about this organization. Hopes were so high in those early days. The hope that we could lay the foundations of world government. The hope that we could organize economic recovery and military security on a worldwide basis. That we could smash down the barriers of race and ideology which caused friction and war between nations. These hopes were sincerely and deeply felt by hundreds of millions of people throughout the world. And alas, it must be confessed that on the whole, they have been grievously disappointed. The setbacks began early after the war, with the increasing use by the Soviet Union of the veto in the Security Council, which in effect completely stultified the Council's work. This was accompanied by a refusal on the part of the Soviet Union to participate in many of the organs of United Nations, And often, where they did participate, they used the debates not for attempts to divide, not for attempts to cooperate with the member governments represented there, but for attempts to divide one non-communist government from the other and to weaken them all in the eyes of their public opinion at home. I recall a particular instance of this with particular feeling. I remember then I was one of the delegates to the United Nations General Assembly. I suppose it must have been the General Assembly in 1947. And I was taking Committee 3 at that time, and we were dealing with the Draft Declaration of Human Rights, trying to put it into shape by amending it so that the plenary meeting of the Assembly could pass it at the end of the session. Well, I remember one morning when on one particular article of this draft declaration, there were 6 amendments done. That wasn't unusual. I can't remember the names in the of the countries who put the amendments down. Let us say the first was, it might have been a United States amendment. The second was the Soviet amendment. The third maybe the Australian amendment, and so on. Well, the chairman said, "Now I propose that we take them in this order. First, the United States, second, the Soviet, and third, the Australian, and so on. Do you all agree?" So we all said, yes, we agreed. But watching our Soviet colleague all the time from bitter experience, and sure enough, just as we were going on, he asked to take the floor. And the chairman, who was an experienced chairman, said, "Our Soviet colleague does understand, doesn't he, that this is just a matter of procedure. Which amendment do we take first, and so on? Not of time for discussing the substance of the amendments." "Yes," said the Soviet delegate, "he understood perfectly." And he spoke for over 30 minutes, and in the first part of his speech he said that his amendment must be taken first because it raised the whole question of lynching in the southern states of the United States of America. And he gave us a propaganda talk on that. And the second reason he said why my amendment must be taken first is that it raises the whole question of the deliberate starvation under British rule of 2,300,000 Indians between the years 1923 and 1927. And for 15 minutes, he gave us a propaganda talk about that. Well, eventually, all good things come to an end, and he sat down. And it was Mrs. Roosevelt's turn to speak. She was the United States delegate. And she, as you very well know, is a most charming and a delightful and a good Democrat of an American lady. I mean Democrat in the British sense, of a... she made a typical, characteristic, forthright reply. She said she was glad the Soviet delegate had made that speech. She was sure he must feel much better now he got it off his chest. And when my turn came, I said a few sentences in the same spirit, and we sat back. But again, the Soviet delegate took the floor. And for over 30 minutes, he spoke again. And in the first half of his speech, he said that the levity with which Mrs. Roosevelt had treated this deplorable subject of lynching was a scandal. And in the second part, he said that he called the world press and the public opinion of the world to witness that Mr. Mayhew had been unable to bring forward a single fact to refute the detailed charges he'd made about the deliberate starvation of 2,300,000 Indians under British rule. And at the end of it, Mrs. Roosevelt sent me a note to say, "It really doesn't pay to be polite, does it?" Well, now, this long story I only give to illustrate the kind of incident which we were up against then, and we've been up against worse since. And it was incidents like these, and they've become increasingly common, that convinced us, the British, and I think we were ahead of the United States in this, convinced us that it wasn't enough simply to ignore Soviet propaganda at the United Nations. It became clear that this propaganda was having an effect, not perhaps on the delegates at Lake Success, though even here I used to detect a slight drooping of morale under the constant vituperation, but on world public opinion, especially in wavering countries, to which, in fact, this propaganda was, of course, addressed. My government therefore decided that we could no longer sit quietly by and suffer these attacks. We decided, moreover, that it was not enough merely to defend ourselves against the attacks, because then we'd always be fighting on grounds of the Soviets' choosing. It was necessary to counterattack vigorously, to challenge the right of the Soviet Union to hold forth to us on such subjects as peace and freedom and workers' standards. Well, that's what we began doing some 3 years ago. We spoke about Soviet sabotage of peace, about their monstrous system of slave labor, about their denial of human rights. And your delegates, reaching the same conclusion a little later, joined in the battle. Well, nobody, of course, enjoys polemics of this kind. All of us in the West, I'm sure, would much rather conduct the business of the United Nations in a quiet, friendly, business-like way, as we do at conferences where we meet each other. But it seems to me self-evident that if Russia and China are to be in the United Nations, as I think they should be, and if they insist on using it for political warfare primarily, then we must take up the challenge and counterattack vigorously. But of course, the loser in all this is the United Nations itself. And the constant propaganda battles, coupled with the vetoes and the non-participation of the Soviet Union in many organs of the United Nations, led to a distinct decline in public confidence in the United Nations up to the outbreak of the Korean attack last year. And then in June last year, North Korea attacked South Korea. And for the first time in its history, the Security Council acted with real vigor and effectiveness in response to an act of aggression. It did so, I'm afraid, only because of the fortuitous absence of the Soviet delegate. But it did so. And after hard and anxious, but yet exhilarating weeks, the United States forces, the United Nations forces, under the inspired leadership of the United States, drove the aggressors from South Korea, and for a glorious moment seemed to have reasserted the rule of law against the aggressors. But then, of course, came the disaster of Chinese intervention. Their action was, of course, absolutely indefensible. And even if, as I myself believe, it was partly motivated by a genuine, if illusory, fear of being attacked themselves, this doesn't excuse them, because their illusion that they were about to be attacked themselves was entirely of their own creation. If they insist on cutting themselves off from the West, on feeding themselves up with half-baked Marxist ideas about the aggressiveness of the West, then they can't expect to be exonerated from the disastrous consequences of their ignorance. And the same applies to Soviet Russia. But now, in the critical situation which has resulted, surely the statesmanlike attitude for the Western countries is to look beyond questions of blame, to think only of the consequences for humanity of the various courses of action which we may now take. We have many weapons still in our hands. We have every moral justification for using them. We might still have to use them if the Chinese compel us to. But the wise course surely is to restrain ourselves from inflicting upon the Chinese the full penalties which they deserve, from playing into Russia's hands by tying up our limited forces at the wrong time, in the wrong place, against the wrong country. But if that is so, then we must face the fact that the United Nations has suffered a severe defeat. We have to recognize that governments representing nearly one-third of mankind will have fought against the United Nations flag, or assisted those who are fighting it, and profited from the aggression. This means a loss of moral prestige to United Nations. It means that on future occasions, united action to resist aggression will be harder to organize. It means that the enemies of peace and of the United Nations will feel less reluctant to start new aggression in other places. it rubs home the sad lesson that in the world as it is today, United Nations doesn't determine the relations between the great powers, but is itself determined by them. Well then, what value remains to United Nations? Well, it depends on what kind of an organization we mean to have in the future. Some people feel, and it's a natural feeling enough in the circumstances we're in, some people feel that after Korea, there can be no place in a genuine peace organization for Soviet Russia and China. But in spite of everything, I do not agree. And nor, I am sure, do the great majority of British people. No doubt it's a bad time at present to invite communist China into the United Nations. But I'm sure that if UN is to have any value for peace in future, then in due course, both Russia and China must be there. Suppose we did try to expel the Soviet Union. I'm not at all sure how one could do it under the Charter, but suppose we did try.